This is the Scale with Psychology podcast, where you're going to optimize your psychology to exponentially scale your business and become the ultimate version of yourself. I'm your host, Ani Manian, widely known as the Mind Whisperer and trusted advisor and psychedelic therapist to the world's top entrepreneurs and leaders. And I believe that entrepreneurship is a mental game. And the main constraint in any business is not the strategies and tactics, but the psychology of the founder. And with each episode, I'm going to help you take your life and business to levels you never thought possible. If you're ready to play the game of life and business in God mode, then this is the podcast for you. All entrepreneurship is the diffusion of innovation. And that's the core idea. What we're doing as entrepreneurs is we are either creating an innovation in the market, which is a better, faster, easier way to experience some sort of desire or make some sort of pain go away. Or we are absorbing it from someone else, and then we are getting so excited about it that we are actually able to diffuse it to more of the market. This chart, this curve, it explains how any diffusion or any innovation is diffused through the market. Whether it's iPhones, whether it's ayahuasca, whether it's toothpaste, whether it's some sort of progressive overload-based fitness training program, literally every single thing that someone pays for, any product or service, follows this behavior. So the blue curve here is the rate of adoption. So we've talked a lot about how success in business basically is how much and how efficiently we're able to absorb energy from the market. So the rate at which a market's willing to adopt our product or solution, that's what this blue curve represents. The yellow curve represents the market share that we own. So obviously at 100, we have a monopoly. We own the entire market. And we've fully diffused this innovation to the point that it has become a mainstream commodity. Of course, monopolies are notoriously disliked. And as soon as one person has some level of success in a market, people see that as a viable business opportunity, and then they try to replicate it, which is great. That's healthy capitalism. That's actually what causes markets to become more sophisticated over time. Different providers of value compete against each other. They try to innovate even more. And then, of course, the market overall benefits from a healthy level of competition. Now, the first people to adopt a new innovation are innovators. This is a very, very, very tiny percentage of the market. And these are the percentages that this is, I think, from the 50s by a guy called Roger Everett. It's a book that will cause even the most interested of people to fall asleep almost instantaneously. It's very thick. I think there's 3 volumes. So I'm going to, as concisely but as effectively, explain this so that you can really apply this to what you're doing. So the innovators, these are the people who, when the first iPhone launched, they queued up outside the store overnight. These are the people who bought the first Tesla. They placed the pre-order, they bought the car, they had no idea how it was going to work. They just wanted the newest thing. These people are the first to adopt anything new that comes onto the market. Then you have the early adopters. The early adopters are also pretty early in the innovation curve, in the diffusion curve. So after innovators, it's the early adopters who jump on the bandwagon. And these people are really interesting. So while the innovators are the first to try and they're willing to take risks, they're okay with stuff being unpolished. They're okay with stuff having bugs. They're okay with stuff not working perfectly. They're very tolerant, right? Because they just want the newest thing. The early adopters, these are opinion leaders. These are people comfortable with new ideas, not as friendly to risk as the innovators, a little less tolerance, but these are the people who are still early on the curve. Then, and of course, the early adopters actually sold by the innovators adopting the product. So take Apple, when they release a new phone or a new product, they release it to these people. There's one guy called Marcus Brownlee. I think he has like over 10 million followers on YouTube. And he will review the phone before anyone has a chance to actually see it and use it. And all of the people who follow him look to him for his opinion and his trust. And then they will rush in and they'll place an order. So those are the early adopters. Then you have the early majority. So you can see that this is a much bigger chunk of the market, right? So the early majority, these people, even more risk averse than the early adopters, these people, they need to see more evidence and proof. So what sells these people is what sells these people is actually the success that early adopters and innovators have adopting the new innovation. So basically, while the innovators, they didn't need any proof. The innovator said, "Oh, you have something that's new, that's cool, I'm in. Here's my money." Of course, these are also people who have a higher budget because they have more discretionary income to spend on stuff that they think is cool. The early adopters also need a lot less proof than the early majority. They need only a little bit of activation energy before they're like, "I'm in. I want to try this." Early majority, they want to see proof. They want to see case studies. They want to see testimonials. They want to see results that the innovators and the early adopters got because they actually wait to see the success of the innovation before they adopt it. Not as much as the late majority. Now you see the late majority is another 34% here. The late majority will wait till mainstream validation and adoption. These are the people who waited till toothpaste became a relatively normal thing before they started buying it and using toothpaste to brush their teeth every day. They want to see, they're more risk averse than the early majority. They want to wait and see if the thing works at scale, if the broader market and community adopts it, if people check it out and they're like, "I think this is good," and it's becoming normalized behavior, they're like, "Okay, cool, I'm in." And the last piece here is the laggards. These are the very last to adopt any kind of innovation. These people are very skeptical and they're very resistant to change. Now, there's a couple of interesting things that are applicable here in what we're doing. So, one, as you can imagine, the laggards are the hardest to sell to, right? The late majority are probably the second hardest people to sell to here. The other thing is that because these people, these different segments, innovators, early adopters, early majority, all have different things that they respond to and they have different characteristics, we must talk to them differently. So if we try to sell people who are early majority and early adopters the way we would sell innovators, it's not going to work. They're not going to be turned on, and it's going to create a lot of friction for them. So we must message. So first we got to know who to talk to, who to sell to. Second, we got to know how to speak to them and how to message so that they can receive the pieces of information and they can be talked to in the way they want to be talked to so that they can adopt. Now, this also intersects with market sophistication. So, in any market, in the beginning, it's a brand new market. So, electric vehicles, the market didn't exist until very recently. It was a brand new market. So, pretty much any claim is sufficient to sell the car. You launch something in a brand new market, you launch a brand new innovation, something that the market hasn't seen before. You don't need to do much. You just say, hey, this is an electric vehicle. And here are a couple of benefits, which, the innovators don't really care about. They see that, hey, it's an electric vehicle. I'm in. Then, as the market becomes more sophisticated, what happens is that markets cascade into levels 2 to 5, where level two, now there's more players entering the market. And now you need to compete on making a bigger claim or some sort of better claim than the other guy. So the markets, the skepticism is now increasing, and the market is getting more sophisticated in terms of dealing with that kind of product or solution. And then you have level three, where market's becoming more crowded. So we have to introduce some sort of differentiator that supports the claim and that convinces people. At level four, now it's even more crowded. We have to create some sort of differentiator or unique mechanism that shows that, hey, our way of doing this is way better. So the electric car market hasn't yet gotten to that stage. But if you take something like phones, smartphones are now in a very crowded, saturated market. And then level five, finally, all of these differentiators burn out and the market is very skeptical. And now we have to differentiate on other elements like identity, like values, like why, our purpose, mission, and maybe even create intimacy. Now, one of the big reasons why I'm sharing this with you guys is because what's happening over the past 10 years is that the speed of markets evolving and getting so more sophisticated is increasing. So it used to be that you launch a product, you create marketing, and you create messaging for that product, and you don't need to touch it for 10 years because the rate of innovation and sophistication was so low. So these cycles used to happen over decades. Since smartphones came out, since there's been a acceleration in technology, social media, all of this stuff, what's happening is that these cycles are happening faster and faster and faster, which means as soon as a new product launches, competitors enter the market rapidly, and the market starts to increase in level of sophistication. And what that causes is a challenge in a business differentiating what it uniquely is able to do, even though you may have some unique attributes, some unique qualities and skills and capabilities. It becomes really hard because the market gets noisy, everyone's saying the same stuff, and it's hard to stand out. So what's the solution to this? So part of the solution is, as we saw here, we have some sort of a unique mechanism, right? A unique mechanism is just a different, unique, or special way that we solve a problem, we deliver an innovation or an advantage, we create value. And of course, that you can have different levels of this. You can have an advanced unique mechanism where you can improve upon the unique mechanism when everyone's got a unique mechanism. You can say ours is better. But what we're trying to do here is one thing is that we recognize that given the model we're playing with, you actually don't need a lot of people to hit the goal. So the goal we're playing with is $1 million a year in profit, working 4 hours a day, 4 days a week. So if you just apply the dynamic offer stack and you have one core offer, let's say at the low end it's $300 a week, and I'm not counting the other offers, I'm not counting all the LTV boosters. You need about 70 people in that core offer to generate $1 million a year. Let's say 80, and the other 10 basically offset all of your overhead and expenses. That's not a lot of people. We're deliberately designing businesses that are very low in the amount of overhead and the amount of lift and the amount of stress, because finding 70 people, 80 people is very, very, very manageable. But for these people, what we want to do is we want to have crazy levels of affinity. As in, for those people, we have to be the people for them. We have to become a category of one. So, how do we become competition proof? So, there's three elements that we can incorporate in our business geometry, in our brand, that helps us do that. So, this is the intersection of one, the identity. So, our product or service at the end of the day is designed to create some sort of transformation. They go from one identity to another. So, Matt, in your case, they come in as one person, but when they leave or when they hit their big milestone inside your offering, they literally transform into a different person. Brooks, for you, same thing. Right? They may come in, they might feel a little chubby, they might feel fatigued, they have some brain fog, they don't feel fit, they have low energy. It's all, you know, they just don't feel good. And maybe they feel shy taking their shirt off at the beach. But after going adopting your innovation and, you know, reaching some level of saturation in terms of adopting your product, now they've transformed into a different person altogether. They've lost 20 pounds. Maybe they can see their abs for the first time. They feel great about themselves. So, our product, solution, or service is an agent of transformation. And we can incorporate this by talking a lot about who they're becoming, not just what they're buying. Because ultimately, what people are buying is who they're becoming. The product or service is just a vehicle to get to that destination in terms of their identity. And of course, the other piece of identity here is your identity, because they're buying from you. So ultimately, they're actually buying your values and they're buying your identity. On some level, they're seeing you as the role model, as the embodiment of who they're becoming, who they want to become. So the more you can incorporate your identity into your brand, into all of those touch points with the market, the more it creates a moat. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a moat that's defensible. We're trying to create a business that is protected as the market saturates, as the market becomes more commoditized. So the first moat is identity. And the moat is basically created by things that cannot be replicated. Because if it can be replicated, then it's not a moat. So the first piece of the moat is identity. No one can replicate you, your unique story, your hero's journey, what you've accomplished, what you've created your life to be. And that's ultimately a part of what the business is selling. The second piece of this is the mechanism. So, over the course of your journey and your experiences, you've created some sort of mechanism that has allowed you to solve a problem for yourself, which now you're offering to the market and saying, hey, I did this for myself. I've done this for a bunch of people. I can help you with this as well. So what is that special secret sauce? What is that unique process? And how is that different from all the other processes? How is it faster? How is it easier? How is it simpler? How does it save them from complexity or discomfort or pain or complication? How does it make their life easier? And the last piece of this is the world. So ultimately, this is another huge moat in a world where AI is making it so that we don't know what real is. We can't tell what's real from fake. The only true moat that's going to exist will be authentic, vulnerable humanity. So this, how we apply this is we have to create a world for our customers, our market to live inside of. We want to invite them inside this world. Eli does this amazingly well. So when he Instagrams pictures from his business class seat going to Italy and toasting champagne on a balcony in Paris, he's inviting people into his world. He's allowing people to witness it and fall in love with his world. And this is where we get to show more of ourselves. This is where we get to invite people into our life in whatever way is that feels right. So an extreme example of this is someone like Kim Kardashian. What has allowed her to become so rich is that she is making a transaction. The transaction she's making is that I will give you unlimited vulnerability because I'm going to have a camera crew following me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, pretty much. And you will have unfettered access to my life. And you can literally step inside my life because I will open my world to you. And then I will, in exchange, take some money. Of course, the end user is not paying the money. It's, you know, whoever owns the channel. But basically, she's able to make massive amounts of money just being herself because she allows people to step into her world. And we can do this to whatever level feels appropriate and accessible for us. And if we can slot these pieces together and we can build this on top of an innovation that we're bringing to the market, and we're very, very cognizant about what stage of sophistication our market's in. How does that segment of the market want to be talked to? What do they respond best to? Then what we can do is we can capture maximum energy from that market as efficiently as possible. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you found value, please consider leaving a 5-star review to allow the show to reach more people, or share this episode via your social media channels. If you're an entrepreneur and want support in exponentially scaling your business, email me at ani@animanian.com.